Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Just before you listen to this admittedly wonderful podcast, I want to tell you how you can get hold of the matchday program for the Champions League final, even if you don't go to Madrid. It's a beautiful document, and in recent years, it's been one of the highlights of my season to contribute to this program. In the recent past, I've written about Celtic on their way to the Champions League final in 1967 against Inter Milan, how they sallied off into the Estoril Woods to find a Scottish golf professional so they could watch England versus Spain live on the TV, and how Celtic got lost on the way to the Lisbon final the following day, how Brian Clough insisted on having a crate of beer on the way to the Olympic Stadium in Munich for the final in 1979. I've written about choosing the best goal from all the European Cup finals and Champions League final. I went with Mandzukic, by the way, from Cardiff, and I'll argue with anybody who disagrees. I've written about the pre-match press conference, the art of starting the game 24 hours early. And in this season's issue, I've written about the thrills and spills, the most extraordinary semi-finals this competition, in either of its forms, probably has ever seen. It's filled with beautiful art, wonderful spread pictures, great writers, and it's a memento for all time. And you can still order a copy of the Champions League final program and the Europa League final match program from European-Knights.com. We do try to look after you.
Hello, everybody. For Backpage, my name is Neil White, and this is the big interview with Graham Hunter, who is on the line from Barcelona to talk with me about Saturday's Copa del Rey final, which finished Valencia 2, Barcelona 1.
I'm also on a concrete bench looking up at the blue sky over Barcelona. And that helicopter you can hear and will continue to hear isn't anything to do with the sort of end scenes of Goodfellas. And they're not coming to get me. But it's where I choose to record this part of our lovely conversation.
Graham Hunter is down the line from Barcelona and slow cooking a tomato sauce.
I wasn't going to tell you about the thinly sliced garlic, but, you know.
Using the razor blade. Listen, everybody, I hope you all listened to the preview show that Martin and Graham recorded that was out just before the final. Graham focused a lot on Valencia in that podcast and especially their coach Marcelino. The turnaround in their season, the factors behind the turnaround in that season, what a change for them up top. So that was great, and the way the final went, I think it gave us lots of great background. But I want to kind of drag you back first, Graham, and say that there's a nice symmetry to this chat, because my season, 2018-19, began with you going to...
We did. We started off... bloody hell, I mean, it's kicked me in the guts, that. We started off watching the poor, now deceased, owner of Leicester taking off from... the ground, and we'd watched Valencia Leicester. We'd been treated wonderfully by Leicester, and Valencia had introduced us to Diakabi, and at that stage I remember we were up in the hospitality box and looking at this glorious mechanism taking off into the sky. And it's a hell of a thing to think back now to the tragedy that struck that club, and the sadness that imbued Leicester every time, you know, living abroad. I then saw it on the television after having been to that wonderfully welcoming city for what was a cracking game of football. And you and I went to watch it, and 1-1, I seem to remember. We were pretty thrilled by the already clear indications that James Maddison was easily going to make the move up from Norwich. It's a moving class down from Pittodrie and the Mighty Dandies, obviously. And we saw that day for Valencia. I mean, listen, you were billing and cooing over Parejo that day, weren't you?
Yes, I was about to go back there. I still love him.
Even more so now, right?
Yes. He was magnificent in that preseason friendly. He's magnificent kind of every time I see him. But he performed a different role in this game. He seemed to be in Messi's face a fair amount.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Parejo is that, and we've talked about this over and over again, at this level for this club, he's kind of whatever you need him to be, in that he'll pick up the ball outside the penalty area. He'll offer for defenders who are told not to lump it when there isn't a runner. And there's Parejo. And he seems to have, you know, triplet brothers, because he'll be available again in midfield and he'll run onto the ball and finish. And he's done that throughout the season. One of his record goal-scoring totals. And I thought on Saturday night, well, because Messi sort of dropped so deep and played really strongly in the first half at a lesser pace, and I don't mean the fact that he's prone to walking or assessing the game, there was a lack of urgency and intensity, I thought, about Barcelona, irrespective of the way they conceded their two goals. And it's really struck me that the instant Valencia involved Parejo in a constructive move of knocking the ball around, Barcelona couldn't keep up and the first goal was conceded. So while I definitely agree with you that Parejo is a guy who can, you know, make life hard for a deep-lying Messi who likes to have a bit of space to pick the ball up, or who likes to have players around him of the opposition team who'll be a little bit careless and let possession bounce off them, well, Parejo doesn't really do that. And I think that while occasionally he's understated, I'm not going to be sort of hipster and say he's a connoisseur's taste, but I think that there are a lot of people who watch Premier League football who like their midfielders to be a good deal more urgent and more patently piston pumping as they get around the turf, and Parejo is all built on intelligence and positioning and technique and bravery and vision. Always, always, always there for his teammates, showing and saying, I'll take it. And we're into little fine details, microscopic details. I don't know if the socios agree or appreciate or violently disagree, but when in that spell in the game that you were talking about, before Parejo went off injured and before Messi did his level best to rest this cup final back into Barcelona's hands, the thing that really stood out was he just that razor's edge of difference. Whenever the ball, about, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 minutes into the game, when Valencia had been lying very deep and beginning to get a little bit corralled, even though Barcelona weren't doing very special things, they were high up the pitch and Valencia looked a little bit stuck in there. 3-4 times in the space of 5-6 minutes, the ball came to Parejo and he already knew what to do. And it was one touch, two touch, one touch, one touch, two touch. The speed of movement of the ball when it's accurate makes a gigantic amount of difference to what space you occupy, how much time you've got to look for that next pass. When a receiver gets it really quickly, really accurately, and their marker isn't quite there, it's a chain reaction. It goes one thing after the other, domino theory. And Parejo was the dominoes man.
He's been there now 8 years. This is his first trophy. Looking at their return to the Mestalla, you know, and the celebrations that happened there, it's like fantastic for this club, who themselves like ended an 11-year trophy drought. But in particular, the skipper.
Well, that's right. And without repeating what we talked about on Friday, I think it's worth emphasising, you know, that Parejo, when Marcelino arrived, Parejo did a big interview with one of the quality papers in Spain where he said, I was a little bit afraid to go outdoors. He didn't say it in the way that Ander Gomes, who's now at Everton, said about Barcelona, where he was ashamed to go outdoors and that he had something verging between anxiety or depression about the, I'm going to say exigency, but that's a Spanish word that I can't find the British word for, the demands he placed upon himself. He was so shamed, Ander Gomes, about how he was letting himself down that he began to imagine everybody was talking about. Well, everybody was talking about Parejo. He'd been, without being loutishly drunk, he'd been pictured in a club, nightclub late on, drinking, but actually been drunk. I mean, goaded by somebody with a, he didn't know, had a video phone in her hands, been goaded, saying something a little bit derogatory about the previous coach. And there was no question that under Nuno Espirito Santo, Parejo was, how would I put it? He was enjoying a lot less the training ground atmosphere, the brand of training, the relationship he had with the coach. And, you know, that's a footballer's lot. There's no way you have a career that starts at Real Madrid and goes to QPR, then Getafe and Valencia, and you play from, you know, you play professionally from the age of 18 and until you're 30 now, and everything is sweetness and light. Just doesn't happen to anybody. But the way in which Marcelino came in and just tapped him on the shoulder and said, listen, don't go. Parejo was about to go, he and his wife were like, it's not that we don't feel safe in this city, but it's like we get heckled in the street, people have lost faith, I'm not enjoying life anymore, this needs to change, I love my football, and therefore the place that I, you know, I practice my football needs to be far more enjoyable than this. And, you know, that's how close. It was a razor-thin edge between him being a player of another club. And I think it's worth noting in this podcast that Ernesto Valverde asked last summer Barcelona to sign Parejo. And, in fact, yeah, I was going to say, was it last summer or the summer before? But he was a specific petition from Valverde to say, I know the style of football at Barcelona demand and the ethos of the Cruyff style Barcelona, Guardiola style Barcelona, and there's a specific player who embodies that. So it must have been actually summer number one. I apologise, because they brought him Coutinho instead, the following Christmas. So when you talk about Parejo, I think it's not just now the storyteller's urge to say, ah, look, he came back from the brink of disaster to the cup final. I agree with you that he's put 8 good years in there. He's taken them into Europe. He played, I won't renege because I was right, it was true. But, you know, in the first 2.5 months of the season, I wrote very critically about Parejo, because if anybody wants to go back and look at his performance against Juventus at home in the Champions League, which was crucial to win, where Ronaldo gets sent off. Parejo gives away a penalty, knowing that Juventus' right back that day is a former Valencia player, Cancelo, who Parejo had played against umpteen times in training, and he's trying to clear the ball, and he knows Cancelo's quick, and he misjudges what Cancelo's about to do. Calamitous is only close to it, inexplicable manner. Gives away the penalty, Juventus score. Parejo is narky throughout the game. They win a late penalty, even at 2-0, they win a late penalty. You never know what happens if he puts it in, he misses it. I'd noticed him in a game at Mestalla, dabbling away at an opposition midfielder, whereby he was very lucky not to be sent off. The following week, away to Villarreal, in a 0-0 draw when Valencia couldn't score, couldn't win. He does get sent off. There was a scorpion in his underpants, and I don't know why, but there was a problem, and he seemed to be reacting to it in a way which was letting down the previous year he had, which was magnificent under Marcelino. Parejo looked to me like, and absolute stick-on Spain player, an archetypical Spain player. The last coach ignored him. This coach has brought him in. I don't know if his injury gets cleared soon enough to go to the Faroe Islands or to play against Sweden. Simply being happy for a guy who's got his kids on the pitch and his wife with him, and he was crying basically non-stop from the time he went off to when the final whistle went to when he was interviewed on television afterwards. It's nice to see somebody being overcome with emotion for the right reasons. But I think it's slightly bigger there. At a time when Spanish club football has, for the first time in I don't know how many years, not won a European trophy, which would probably date back to, I guess, 2013 maybe. And when Barcelona, again, have been blown away because they're not as intense or super fit as a Liverpool, or and when Barcelona, neither Barcelona nor Real Madrid, nor indeed Spain, retain the ball and keep it and move opposition about as we've become used to over the last 10, 11, 12 years. Parejo stands as a testimony to what it should be like and what it used to be like, and I'm thrilled to see him reaping the rewards for playing the way he does.
By no means a one-man show, though. On Saturday, there were fantastic performances from Valencia all over the pitch. Jaume, who the goalkeeper, who kind of typically for Spanish and European football only tends to play in the cup competition, made a ton of really, you know, like A-minus, B-plus saves to kind of keep Valencia ahead. And then at the top, super sharp, the marquee signing from the summer, Kevin Gamero, scores the first, and Rodrigo the second, a guy who we spoke a lot, Graham, about during the World Cup when we're doing that daily show.
Well, it's funny, you talked about bookends when you and I started at Leicester 1-1 Valencia, and the season finishes with Valencia winning the cup, at least the Spanish domestic season does. The bookends are Rodrigo's brilliant goal, outstanding goal on the first day of the season against Atleti, and then an utterly bewildering dearth of goals where, yeah, there were matches when Rodrigo lost confidence or maybe did the wrong thing. And I won't repeat what I said, but for anybody who didn't listen on Friday, Saturday, the point at which a lot of partnership building time was wasted by playing Batshuayi, who had no idea how to link with Rodrigo, and therefore it took longer for the developing understanding with Mina to keep growing and for Gamero and Rodrigo to understand each other. And when that did click after Christmas, okay, it still took Rodrigo a little while to find the goals, but there was a match in the middle of the Champions League against the Swiss opposition when Mina and Rodrigo really clicked, and you thought, yeah, okay, this guy, Rodrigo hasn't been a one-season wonder. This is going to come. Rodrigo's unbelievable willingness, to keep making the runs, completely undaunted by his Frank Spencer finishing, and then his unerring idea that if he's in the right position, he must finish, and if he's got somebody in a better position, he must pass. That's why he's not an out-and-out number nine, because, you know, true dyed-in-the-wool number nine centre-forwards don't think like that. He's in the Benzema mould. He's a very good footballer, very good athlete. So, yeah, the look of sheer joy on his face the ball in is absolutely sensational, I would say.
Soler, right?
Yeah, which again I'm pleased about, because Soler is a 10. He's been at the club since he was 8. If he eventually is played in a 4-2-3-1 formation and he's the middle of the three behind the one striker, then Soler will immediately, I think, show himself to be European class, and there'll be a mega market for him and so on. He's a diamond of a player who copes with being asked to play wide in a 4-4-2, because, you know, across his 2 years at Valencia, Marcelino, I think, has only twice played 3-5-2 and no other formations apart from 4-4-2. During a match, you know, it might morph into 4-5-1, but the skeleton is always 4-4-2. And therefore, Soler really, apart from a handful of occasions when literally Coquelin and Condogbia are injured and Vaz isn't playing in next to Pareko. In fact, it probably needs three central midfielders to be injured before Soler is even tried in central midfield. And even then, that's an adapted position because he is a true number 10. And, you know, he's been ripping up records and making people swoon at Valencia since the kid was 8 or 9. And therefore, to see him using that, you know, that his that bastardized position for him where he really is just told, you know, do your shift. And getting past Alba and rocketing that ball in, the ball's brilliant. It still needs a lot of work. I don't know what you thought, but I thought Rodrigo still had to react really well. And I've seen a ball of that pace rocket off somebody as if they've got a triangular head. And I thought Rodrigo's poise was brilliant in that minute.
Yeah, it's an old-fashioned number nine run to decide to go to the keeper, basically, instead of kind of holding back.
It is, I agree with you, but you know what he shows? I think he shows that he trusts Soler's delivery. He knows that that channel between the keeper, who's, remember, a reserve keeper, who hasn't played a lot. I do adore Cillessen, but, you know, these haven't been his best weeks. He's been, you know, absent for a very long time because the, you know, the Copa semi-final was a chunk of time ago, and therefore, you know, I think that while it absolutely was an old-fashioned centre-forwards run, he's judged two things, that, you know, there may be a little bit of hesitation on Cillessen's part, and secondly, he just knows that Soler is brilliant enough to ping that ball at the right height, at the right pace, into the channel between the defenders and Cillessen, and, you know, good on him for guessing right and trusting.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I want to talk more about the sort of psychological scars and that they've picked up in the latter stage of this season. I mean, a lot's been written and said by Barcelona players, amongst other people, about the sort of lineage of this defeat coming from the second leg of the Champions League game against Liverpool. Do you buy into that? Do you think that the end of their season has been defined by that defeat?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do, because it, when they talk about it, and the two you are referring to are Piqué and Messi, and there are few you'd rather listen to when they're not doing something that's corporate or commercial, and when they're speaking from the heart, you're listening to two of the leaders, two of those who are the most stern about winning all the time and who, what would you call it, sting the most when they lose. So when Piqué says that it was a brutal experience at Anfield, when he admits that they were lacking, once you listen closely to Messi and Piqué saying it was our fault, and when you listen to them talking about not being able to react and the degree to which Rome last year when they were 4-1 up from a match, it was so similar. And the only remedy is change. Because yes, I do believe them. I do believe that they're scars. And I do. When you hear Piqué, and I don't have the word power to describe to people what a brutal competitor he is. And when he talks about memories of Rome haunting him on that night in Anfield, that's not a throwaway line. That you know, that's the psychiatrist here, and that cuts right to the core. And once you've got something that you need to excise, you know, it's tautological to say anything else. Excise it. There needs to be a cutting away at people who are perma-scarred in that squad. Now, there are other arguments, completely separate but parallel arguments, about what brand of football do you want, and Xavi's talking about, you know, not until they learn to dominate possession and control a game. Well, that's true. That is true. But it's a separate, albeit concurrent, debate. There are people in that squad now who I think, or at least enough of them have suffered that enough times that some of those simply need to be sacrificed. Whether you can say on a scale of 1 to 10, he is more or less traumatized than him, change is just, it's not just necessary, it's inevitable.
It's fascinating to hear you say that. And the fact that you've got individuals there who might still have success in the rest of their career, but together as part of that collective, it gives them weakness. You've seen FC Barcelona go through these moments. Are you talking about coach and what, 3, 4, 5 senior players? How do you think it's going to unfold? Who makes the decision?
You make a point because I used an analogy about the, you know, the human body and about excisions. And if you've got a doctor who diagnoses what's wrong with you, but your surgeon's drunk, then you're still screwed. Or if he's thinking about the golf or his mistress. And the long and short is that, you know, Bartomeu as president has done some good things. Appointing Valverde was a good choice. I think that's unquestionable. I think that, off to my taste, bringing Eric Abidal into the fold is a good idea. I think that renewing Messi, renewing relationships, or actually building relationships with the Cruyff family. There are a number of things where we can say that Bartomeu's done good things. But Pep Segura being appointed as overall head of technical decision-making at Barcelona is wrong. He holds a template in his mind which is utterly alien to the Barcelona of the last... Well, since Rijkaard took over, which goes back to 2003. You know, with bumps in between when Luis Enrique's style was a little bit more vertical, but, you know, it built itself around Xavi and Iniesta all the same. So I don't regard it as different, just a variant. And Tata Martino, well, that was a one-season experiment. But broadly, Pep Segura has just got no relationship, in my view, with the way in which Barcelona needed to develop from where they were at. That's the crucial thing. So if Barcelona do want to prepare themselves for the return of Xavi in 2021, which is the right thing to do, it's the John Stuart Milne thing to do, the utilitarian idea, then I don't feel that Pep Segura should be staying or making the decisions. Valverde is a heated subject and we could spend all day on it, so let's avoid that prospect by simply saying Valverde has been a brilliant player manager. He's resolved problems, he's kept egos in check. If people condemn him out of hand for what he's achieved, then they're buffoons. I don't know if Valverde needs to go or not, although the criteria upon which I would judge Neil would be if there's not going to be a great deal of change other than what's been booked already, which is Griezmann and Frankie de Jong, then it's feasible that Valverde stays. If Bartomeu, which is not his way, is going to say, right, I actually now understand that this club needs to reorientate itself to playing in a possession way, then Valverde is not that coach. So I think anybody just says Valverde out is not engaged in any kind of, you know, it's more like, what was it? What was the program with Dusty Bin in it? You know, the 3-2-1 people are saying, Valverde out. And the University Challenge people are saying, well, let's see what the club wants to achieve over the summer and next season before we decide upon the coach. But I think there can be major investments by a club which is running out of money at right back, at left back to challenge Jordi Alba. Cillessen leaves, so there must be a keeper challenging Ter Stegen. And there is now a serious debate about how often and in what against what rival Busquets must be an automatic starter, because physically and athletically there's been a gigantic change in him. And it's patently obvious that if they get Griezmann, then it's about accommodating Dembele, Griezmann, Messi and Suarez. And I think they do get him, because I think that deal is set up. The excising of those who've suffered trauma can neatly conjoin with the tactical and sporting needs of this, you know, the best 11 that you get out of Barcelona's. And to be quite frank, you know, amidst all of that cauterizing, they need to find a market for Coutinho, because he has not fitted, And at this stage, there are certain players in certain circumstances where you say, he merits more time. This can still work. And in my judgment, that is not the case for Coutinho.
The point that you started with was about the decision-making tree, and I wonder if there's the appetite for that volume of change.
I don't know if there's the skill, because you know the amount that they've spent on Dembele, Coutinho, renewing Messi, renewing Busquets, renewing Ter Stegen, the amount that they will spend on not only De Jong and Griezmann, but I think that they're far closer to getting De Ligt than many in the media are saying. I think De Ligt is a 70-30 shot to come to Football Club Barcelona, and I don't think really there's been anything other than a game played with Minarella about the Manchester United interest in order to make Barcelona feel that there's a market and pay more. And so I don't know exactly how that will finish, but on balance, I think it's a 70-30 shot that De Ligt comes to Barcelona. That's unbelievable money they have to spend, given that their backs are all already against the wall financially. And therefore, the skill that you need to be able to not only sell, but sell looking at the buyer straight in the eyes and pretend it's not a buyer's market, that takes a lot of wit, a lot of cojones, a lot of favours, because everybody's going, I will take, you know, Coutinho off your hands for 50 million. And you're like, whoa, whoa, that's a 70 million loss. You're like, suck it up, baby.
Okay, let's park Barcelona and finish back with Valencia. I mean, we're talking about Barcelona's summer being possibly one of change, turmoil, certainly self-reflection. Does this match completely change Valencia's summer? Or let's say, does the last month of the season change their summer?
I think you, Fred, have steered your way neatly into the right question there, because...
Thank you.
Copa del Rey, I think, should be cathartic. There can be an unleashing of, we can do it. That God, I love lifting silverware and I want it again. Yeah, that can happen. I wholeheartedly agree. Their debt is at or around 500 million euros. And although it's shared out between, local institutions and debt that Peter Lim incurred in order to buy the club, it's a heavy burden, Neil. They've begun work again on the new Mestalla, and therefore their position remains really precarious. And the thing that made them special over these last 2 years was, as soon as Mateo Alemán, who is the chief organising force at that club, came in and dumped Quique Setién, who was about to be the manager, and appointed Marcelino, their signing has been, you know, not without error, but really good. To be able to persuade Neto to come and sign, to be able to persuade Condogbia to come on loan and then sign, to be able to take Geddes on loan, calculating that this was a player who wanted to play more, but also that Paris Saint-Germain would probably sell him because of FFP. These have been masterstrokes. These have been so clever. And Marcelino revitalising Dani Parejo. The revitalising applies to Rodrigo, applies to Gaia. All, and the promotion of Ferran and the promotion of Soler, all of these things point Marcelino as out as probably Spain's coach of the year the last 2 years, I think. No harm to Zidane and his Champions League, but pound for pound, I think the last 2 years have made Marcelino coach of the year each time. That, or Bordalas is in there this year for sure, but ultimately, when you look at Marcelino winning the cup and getting fourth position, pound for pound, that's where I go. And when I've been talking to people who know him and who've worked with him at a variety of different clubs, there is a common feeling that right now across the globe, he's the number two most talented coach of Spanish origin after Pep Guardiola. And by that, I mean coach. I think he's had to learn in man management terms. So I'll come back to your question. I apologise. Their wits are going to be at the forefront. If you ask about the Copa del Rey unleashing something special, I do agree that, you know, that 99 Cup win unleashed a winning generation at the Mestalla and made everybody unified behind, it's not just we want to knock over the big boys, we want to win. I don't think they're title winners. But there's really delicate things to come at Barcelona and Real Madrid. Really, and at Atleti. So if Valencia, if I were sitting in a room right now with Marcelino and Alemán and Marcelino's football director, who is somebody with whom he shares an agent, so there's a nice cosy relationship there, I'd be sitting in that room saying, yeah, our objective is to win the title. That's how we decide who we're keeping, what loans we take, what money we can afford to. And you would want to, financially, you would have probably two objectives. One is to get through the Champions League group and into the big money stages. And two, I'm not certain that defending the cup would be anything other than your number three priority. Because while winning the title right now would be a leap for this squad, with retaining the right players, finding a right back, because Pacini can't defend. We saw Pacini that day at Leicester, you and I, and he looked lovely going forward. The season has proved that he's not a very good defender. And therefore, a defensive right back, and probably, I'm not certain how many more elite seasons Garaya's got in him injury-wise, but at any rate, with the right confection, your goal at Valencia is to win the title. And it might take you two or three seasons, but there's an opportunity now for a side that's not Barcelona, Madrid or Atleti that there hasn't been, I don't think, probably since Sevilla were at their absolute peak or before that Valencia.
Perfect. And a perfect way for us to end this look back on the Copa del Rey final, and I guess the La Liga season in general. We'll be back very soon with a preview show and then a review show of the Champions League. But for now, Graham Hunter, thank you very much.
Neil White, you'll never walk alone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.